This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
On Friday night, the status of world politics changed. We know it changed for the short term. Will it have lasting effects? We talk about that now on Tactics. Good morning. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, that is the way to get in touch with me. If you want to voice your opinion, you can also tweet me at Tactics Radio. So there's no shortage of ways to get in touch with me to have your opinion on the air, and we certainly encourage you to do that. There are a couple things that I wanted to mention this morning, but of course we have to start with, and I think that it's imperative that we do, what happened late Friday night with the bombing of Syria. Now, there's a couple things to unpack here, and we're going to go over the details and kind of what it means, but I think that it's important to ask the questions about the short term versus the long term, because of course this is going to have a very drastic impact on world politics here in the short term. The question is, what are the long-term ramifications? What does this mean going forward? And unfortunately, there are not a lot of good answers. I'm going to do the best that I can to sort through it. I'm going to give you my thoughts on it. Feel free to call in and give me your thoughts on it. But as of yet, we're not 100% sure. There's not a great guess, to be honest. Even the people that have been doing this forever, who have been really looking into this, at best, their guesses are speculation. And here's a great example. When the bombing took place last year in Syria, we were convinced that that was going to cause us to go to war with Russia. I myself didn't say for sure that we were going to war with Russia, but I said you have to consider that as a possibility. And of course, we know eventually what happened is that did not happen. However, if you look at it through the prism of what we know now, I think that When the first bombing happened in Syria, we kind of got a little bit away from it, and initially we were very scared, we were very frightened, and we had reason to be concerned. And then, maybe a month later or so, that concern kind of faded, and kind of faded even more with time, to the point to where, after some time, we felt like, well, that really didn't matter all that much. We may have overstated the importance of it, but here in the past couple weeks, that event has really kind of shaped what's happened here in recent history, which means that even though for a while it didn't seem like the original bombing of Syria with the 59 missiles had a impact on the world stage, had a lasting impact on global politics, we see now that it definitely did. It absolutely did. And so because of that, it is important to ask what the long-term effects are going to be and do the best that we can to keep in mind that even though this may, in the coming months, seem to fade in importance, and it may do it, it may not do it. It just depends on what all the players, how they react, and what's going to happen in the next few months. But it's important to keep that in mind, that just because this story might fade from the headlines here in the next few weeks, it does not mean that it is not having an impact on our relationships with other countries. So what will happen now is not entirely clear. However, to get a better understanding of how it's going to affect you, you need to know the details. First of all, this was a joint operation between us, France, and the UK, which launched surface-to-air missiles. So one thing that someone was talking about to me, and, you know, there was no malice or anything like that. They just were unsure about what happened. They were talking about kind of the old style bombing, and they were surprised that Russia didn't shoot down our planes. Well, these were surface to air missiles. So there were not fighter jets or bombers flying over Syria. These were missiles that were surface to air. So they impacted. They were, I believe, actually launched from warships is actually, if I'm not mistaken, the method that they used to deliver it. But, you know, you may want to double check me on that. But either way, surface-to-air missiles, they targeted three sites associated with Syria's chemical weapons program, which, by the way, these three sites included a weapons lab and a storage facility. So not only where the weapons themselves were stored, but also the storage facility, or sorry, but also the lab where they were created. And based on what the intel that we have so far, these were not the only targets. We believe that there are other weapons caches, there are other labs that are producing these things, but we think we hit the biggest ones and decimated the chemical weapons program there in Syria. Hopefully that is the case. At least that's what the initial reports are saying right now. And the White House has proposed another strike if this happens again. So they've essentially said, if we see another incident of chemical weapons being used against a civilian population, this is going to happen again. So the White House has already promised this. There has already been a line in the sand, and Nikki Haley talking to the UN the day after it happened there on Saturday basically explained what happened and took kind of a pot shot at Obama, actually, with saying that when our president, of course, talking about Donald Trump now, draws a red line in the sand, that is going to be enforced. And so essentially letting the world know, you were all aware of what happened with the predecessor, where he said that we were drawing a line in the sand with Syria, he crossed that line and Obama did nothing. That is not going to happen anymore. When Donald Trump says there is a red line, he intends to enforce it. So that was a very bold message by our UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, and one that so far has been followed up on, because twice now this has happened and twice now the United States has responded in pretty severe fashion. And if they continue to do this, it appears as though the White House continues and does not intend to back down whatsoever. If this happens again, they are threatening to launch another attack. And it's important to note as well that, and this is one detail that I think has gone somewhat underreported, at least from the coverage that I've seen, because I think this may be the most significant thing that happened. These airstrikes have estimated to kill a little bit over 100 Russian operatives. That's the latest reporting. So maybe this is Russia overemphasizing what has gone on, because you have to keep in mind that this was information coming from them. Maybe they're overstating that. Maybe they're doing it to drum up support for their cause or whatever it is. It could be a political game, but nonetheless, it is not that far-fetched to believe that many Russian operatives were killed in this attack. So that is going to have lasting implications, I believe, on the world stage and in our relationship with Russia and in our relationship with other countries. So this is kind of where I wanted to start out today. Do you think that this was necessary? Do you think that this was the right call? Because this is a very difficult situation, a very difficult position for the White House to be in and for our country to be in. And so I was wondering, what do y'all think on this? What are your thoughts on this? Because I've heard a vast range of ideas, really, from people on both sides. There are people on the left that say, I don't like Trump, I don't like the way he handles things, but honestly, he did a pretty good job on that. I've also heard people from the left, of course, that are saying that Trump's a monster and he's going to take us into World War III. Got into a lovely discussion with a guy who tried to argue that Trump is worse than Putin, and he would switch Putin for Trump in a moment, which, you know, that just gives you an idea of some of the insane people on the left. But nonetheless, there are also conservatives that are saying, and frankly, I tend to fall somewhere slightly closer to the libertarian position on this, that it's not a good idea for us to get involved in foreign affairs like this, especially when we do not have a very clear vested interest in going to war with Syria and a foreign power like Russia. And then you've got other people on the other side that are cheering the president for his swift and decisive action. So I really do want to know where you are on this. And you don't necessarily have to tell me your political stance, but I'm interested in hearing what all of you have to say about this. 860-1440. We have a call on the line. We have two more. So 860-1440 if you want to call in.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
There must be religion. When that ligament is torn, society is disjointed and its members perish. The most important of all lessons is the denunciation of ruin to every state that rejects the precepts of religion. Governor Morris, signer of the Constitution.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app, 860-1440. That is the way to call if you want to be on the program. Let me know what you're thinking about this whole serious situation. Speaking of that, we're going to go ahead and go to the phones right away. Let's go to Curtis on line one. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Caleb. Three quick comments. First comment is three cheers for President Trump to do what he did, and also thank you to the French people and to the British people to joining us on this in this military strike for the diplomacy that was necessary to get them on board, because obviously it's just good to have more partners. So that was wonderful. It was a wonderful thing that he did from that standpoint. And then at the same time, it just drives me nuts that our other allies, where are the Germans, where are the Italians, where are the Belgians, all these other people that condemn chemical weapons and so forth, and they publicly don't like it. But how come they're not sending their, why can't they send an airplane or two to participate? Now, maybe.
Well, now, word through the grapevine is that Germany came very close to being part of this joint operation and then backed out in the 11th hour. I'm not sure exactly why.
Yeah.
But that's what the rumor is, at least.
Yeah, and they mean just in capabilities. They're not very strong, and I mean it'd be difficult to integrate them into a short term battle plan. But anyway, it was wonderful that. And then my other comment is, from the other side that opposed this, the biggest issue of all is it has embarrassed President Obama, and they want to do anything they can to disguise or get beyond the red, drawing the line in the sand. That is
what they have to protect the legacy, Curtis. That's most important.
Yeah.
I mean, that's more important even than our foreign policy or how we appear on the world stages.
Exactly.
You have to protect Obama's legacy.
Yeah. It has nothing to do with children being gassed or anything. It's just about our pusillanimous President Obama. That's all they care about. But it just shows how weak he was. The world sees it, and thank goodness that Donald Trump is a man of his word with regard to what he did over there. That's my opinion.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Curtis. I appreciate your comments, and I do want to respond a little bit. What he was saying, and Curtis's first point, and I'll try to hit both of them. His first point about there being an allegiance there, there's a couple things that I wanted to break down, and this was actually already in my notes, so Curtis got a little bit ahead of the curve, which I'm perfectly okay with. There's a couple things you need to understand about how this whole operation went down. Getting the French and the British inside the organization to where it wasn't just us acting unilaterally was a really smart move. And it would be great, like Curtis said, if we had had several of our other allies involved in this. It seems like they were hesitant to jump on, at least in a at least in an operation that had to be done this quickly. There were rumors about Germany and also Israel joining the coalition to do something about this. Really, Israel's kind of already involved in this conflict, and so I don't really feel all that bad about them not joining in right away. Just because they didn't join in on this one operation doesn't mean that they are not already involved and they are already a strong ally. And so putting this coalition together and waiting for allies made it a lot harder for the Russians to paint us as some kind of meddling bad guy, because that's typically the narrative that we see when it comes to anything involving warfare, is that when the Americans get involved, they try to paint Americans as the bad guy, as somebody that's just getting in and meddling and you know, Big Brother swinging their weight around. That's a lot harder to do now that it's England and France behind us. And to be honest, I think a lot of this had to do with England and France and a lot of the rest of Europe, they've had enough of Putin's crap. Because we don't talk about this as much because we're, of course, across the pond. But Russia has been really bold and really a pain for a lot of European countries with this. Because not only do you have some of the recent incidents, but for the past couple of years, really, you've had Russia, for example, taking one of their aircraft carriers, going out of their way, wasting fuel and taking the longest possible route to go right by England and the rest of Europe to basically show off and say, we don't care about your laws, your waters, you know, we'll just kind of, I mean, it was kind of like the neighborhood thug that goes into the shop or goes into the yard that he knows he's not welcome just to show that he can, which a mob is a pretty fitting analogy for Russia. But you had that going on, and so the Russians, they've invaded foreign airspace over and over again with very little repercussions. Yeah, of course, you had one of the big stories, and I think this is really what threw both England and, to a great degree, France's weight behind this operation as well. The chemical attack on British soil that put British citizens in the hospital when Russia acted and tried to kill one of its own allies with a chemical nerve agent. And because of that, and because, A, there was a very glaring, bright example of how horrible it is to have chemical weapons. Granted, the ones used in Syria were less advanced than the ones that were used, the Novichok, that was used in the UK to kill a Russian operative. But the point is, they saw firsthand what chemical weapons could do, and more importantly, they've had enough of Russia. And frankly, I don't blame them with everything that's been going on here. And so that was a big win for the president, the way that this was handled. This also gives us far more clout with nations that are kind of on the fence, because it would be one thing for the United States to act unilaterally like we did last time. But the fact that England and France joined in, that gives a lot more credibility to our side of the cause with nations that are kind of on the fence about who they should support and who is the good guy and who is the bad guy. The fact that it was us working together and it was really the big three in the UN. I mean, you also have China and Russia, the Asian countries that tend to oppose us on a lot of measures. But when you're talking about Western civilization, especially the big three working together, that gives a lot of clout to countries that were hesitant or a little bit unsure about exactly where they should fall in this conflict. So a lot of pros given there and a lot of praise to give to Trump, at least on how he handled it with that, getting the coalition together, waiting. Waiting also gave us the ability to, you know, maybe we were able to gather some intel from our allies that we would not have had otherwise. I honestly don't know if that's the case. That's just a possibility. The big con, though, is they probably had time, because we did wait and we didn't act unilaterally, to scatter some of their assets, but we weren't going to hit the whole thing anyway. And I think the president understood that it was more important to make a statement with this attack than it was to actually destroy chemical weapons. We destroyed a lot of them. But the political statement that we will act if necessary and when pushed, that was most important. Take it, Rush.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Philippians 1:21, for to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, that is the way to get in touch with me, or you could always just tweet in at Tactics Radio. If you want to follow me, tweet into the show, have your comments read on the air. We love to get those as well. Let's go ahead and jump to the phones right now. Let's go to James on line one. Good morning, James.
Hey, Caleb. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir. What's on your mind?
I wanted to talk about the Syria bombing thing.
Sure.
But I wondered if you had an email address you wouldn't mind to share that we could, if I could suggest a guest possibly for your show another day.
Well, I actually used to have an email set up back when it was the Patriot Preacher, but you know, we use email so seldom now, we never actually did set up one for Tactics. So I tell you what, you can get in touch with me either on Facebook or you can email the newsradio1440.com. You can go on our website and get our generic one and I will get it to me. Believe me, my program director will, if it's addressed to me, he'll give it to me.
Okay. I'll do that.
Sure.
All right. The Syria situation, you remember former President Obama brokered a deal where all the chemical weapons in Syria were sent to Russia, so they don't have any more. And since Assad has basically won the civil war and this chemical weapons attack did not achieve any strategic aims for him, but it was the one thing that could bring in countries that were more powerful him to defeat him. Would it be more likely that it was actually the Assad regime that did the chemical weapons attack, or some entity that would prefer that Western powers become involved in the Syria war, and especially the United States? Would they be a more likely suspect?
Well, here's what I will say about that. I think the Assad regime did believe, at least, that it was acting on its own, that it was acting in its best interest. But here's the thing. Vladimir Putin would not be in Syria if he did not believe that it was going to directly benefit him. He's not just Assad's buddy, and because he's his buddy, he's going to jump in and help him out. That's not the kind of person Putin is. If it does not directly benefit Russia, he would not be involved. And so I do believe that for whatever reason, I'm having a hard time exactly coming up with the strategy that Putin is pushing here. But I do think that, if nothing else, to continue these very subtle step-ups in aggression that Putin has been doing over the past couple of years, that Putin is using Assad as a puppet, whether or not Assad realizes that or not, I'm not sure. But I do think that Assad would not have made this move without Vladimir Putin's approval, is the way that I'll put that. And I'm guessing it was probably Putin's idea to begin with.
But how is it in Putin's interest for Assad to do the one thing, a chemical weapons attack, that can get the U.S. involved, when Putin supports Assad because he is his puppet, as you correctly said, and he has basically won the civil war and is going to stay in power now, which is Putin's objective.
Right.
And so now that all their objectives have been met, let's have Assad do the one thing that will get the United States involved and put us at risk again. How does that make logical sense?
You know, James, that's the piece of the puzzle I have not yet figured out. I still think that that's probably the motivation, that I do think that Assad doesn't blink without Putin giving the okay first. But I really just I have no idea exactly why that is, but for whatever reason, like I said, Russia has been really bold over the past couple of years, especially with invading international waters, invading international airspace. We saw the attack in the UK just a few weeks ago, and this is not the first time that Russia has killed a Russian operative on foreign soil. We saw the same thing happen, I believe it was about, 18 months, maybe 2 years ago, with another Russian agent that they killed, that they did so much more quietly. So, you know, Russia has been ratcheting up, and they're just poking the bear, as it were. I'm not sure exactly what they gain out of that. Maybe they're using it as a distraction. I'm really not sure. But for whatever reason, Russia is getting really aggressive, and they're slowly ratcheting this up. And I think this is the latest example of that. But thank you so much for your call, James. I do appreciate that. Some good observations there. I got to be honest, that is the one piece of the puzzle I have yet to figure out, and I will do the best that I can to sort it out. Here's where I would... This is the best way that I know to describe it. Putin loves chaos. And when you're not the strongest person on the battlefield, like let's say there's a schoolyard brawl or a prison riot or something like that, you notice how when the convict in a lot of these prison movies want to escape, what they have to do is create a distraction and they create a riot so everybody's fighting and nobody notices them slipping out? To me, that is the most logical explanation of why Putin is doing some of the things that he's doing. I think that that's the most logical one. And if you understand, there's a guy named Alexander Dugin, who is one of Putin's top advisors. If you Google him, by the way, really, really creepy guy, and they have been funding efforts all across the world and getting involved in elections just like they did in our election, and they've done some of this here. They're backing old nationalist alt-right groups, and if you know anything about Putin and his background, he's not somebody that necessarily believes in the mantra of the alt-right. Now, he is a nationalist, but that does not mean that he buys into a lot of the alt-right mentality, the other nationalist groups all across Europe. And yet his people are funding them and backing some of the candidates that they've backed, backing some of their protests, helping fund some of their meetings and their organizations. Why? That makes no sense. It doesn't further Putin's plan at all. unless Putin's plan is to create chaos and fear. Again, I'm not sure what Putin's endgame is, but it seems to me that because Putin has said that he does want to basically bring the band back together and bring back the USSR, this is a guy who believes that the fall of the Soviet Union was the biggest geopolitical tragedy of the 20th century. Those are his words, not mine. That I believe what Putin understands is that he does not have the sheer force to impose his will on the world. So I think he believes that it is far smarter to create chaos and create an environment where, despite not being the biggest or the strongest, he can still wind up winning out in the end. And if you understand some of the philosophy of Alexander Dugin, which is, again, one of his top advisors, his symbol and one of the things that he preaches is chaos. The actual logo, the eight-sided star, that is the logo of his political movement is the symbol for chaos. And so breeding resentment, breeding chaos around the world, causing all these minor fires that people now have to go around and put out, I think that is what Putin is doing right now. I don't know necessarily what his endgame is, but if I had to guess, that is his strategy to create as much chaos and as much unrest and upheaval as possible so that when they're basically in the fog of war, Putin can come in and take power. I think that's what he's doing right now. That's my best guess. Now, what his endgame is, who can say? I think that whatever it is, it has a lot to do with him putting together the USSR. Because like I said, Putin doesn't do anything that he doesn't believe directly benefits Russia, at least in one way or another. So Russia, speaking of that, has promised retaliation, and I believe genuinely that Putin intends to deliver, if at all possible. Russia has been bragging that they have a new missile that can reach speeds of Mach 10. Now, keep in mind, this is Russian reporting, so who can say whether that's true or not? But if it happens to be true, that is a big problem because our missile defense systems will not be able to keep up with that. It would be very difficult. It's difficult to hit any moving target, but one that's moving at Mach 10, that's almost impossible even for the world's most advanced weapons defense. And I'm not an expert in this stuff. I'm just going off of what the experts that were interviewed in different articles about this are saying. But you have to keep in mind as well that even if they have missiles, even if they were to deliver a missile, it doesn't necessarily have to be a nuclear warhead. It would only take about 3 MPs that were strategically placed to black out most of the United States. And if that happens, we will be absolutely crippled because everything relies on the computer. Heck, radio broadcast that existed long before computers. If our computer systems went out, we would not be on the air because everything runs on computers now. And an EMP, I mean, that would take out all electronic technology anyway, so it wouldn't matter. That would take out radio and, I mean, that would take out, you know, your TV and everything else. So an EMP wouldn't matter. But one of the things that I wanted to bring up is that they're also, I think, planning a cyber attack, which would have devastating effects, maybe not to the extent of an EMP, which would just take out all electronics, but a cyber attack that is aimed at the right system could certainly really cripple our country. And remember how seriously Russia is taking this, because Russia has already told its citizens to prepare for a nuclear war with the United States. Why would they do that? Think about it. Why would they do that? Why would they start preparing their citizens to go to nuclear war with the United States, talking to them about food preparation, talking to them about getting to the nearest fallout shelter, instructing them on how to handle a nuclear attack when it takes place? Why are they doing all that? Well, there's a couple reasons. First of all, potentially they think it helps them in a PR standpoint. In other words, because it appears as though they're really scared about nuclear war with the United States, that it helps rally the citizens to their cause and to support them in going after the United States in some meaningful way. That's a possibility, and that may be part of it, but I think the more pressing and more logical conclusion to come to when you're looking at that is that what may be happening is that they know this is not where this ends. Because they have promised retaliation, And they're afraid that whatever, because I don't think that Putin believes. I have a hard time believing that Putin thinks that because there was going to be a chemical weapons attack, that the retaliation of that would be to aim a nuke at Russia. Putin's not that dumb. He doesn't believe that the United States would do that. That in a response to a Syrian attack, that they're all of a sudden we're going to send a nuke to Moscow. Putin doesn't believe that. You can't convince me that Putin believes that. So I think that what the reason that that is actually happening is because Putin is planning on launching a counterattack, and he's afraid that our reaction to his retaliation may be that severe. Again, it's either that or they're launching it as a PR campaign to help drum up support for their cause in, you know, whatever effort it is or whatever step it is that they take against America. I'm not sure exactly what that's going to be, but whatever it is, they have promised retaliation, and I really do believe that Putin's going to deliver on that. So a lot of reasons for concern here. Whatever it is, Putin believes, I think, that it is severe enough to warrant a very severe response from the United States of America, to the point that he is talking to his own people about preparing for nuclear war. Now, this may be a worst-case scenario thing. I'm really not sure. But the point is, Russia is taking it incredibly seriously. I think we should be doing the same. 860-1440. We'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The great pillars of all government and of social life: virtue, morality, and religion. This is the armor, my friend, and this alone that renders us invincible. Patrick Henry.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, that is the way to get in touch with me if you would like. We're continuing to talk about the situation in Syria, what's going on with them. And I think the response to this, because like I said before the break, Russia has promised some kind of retaliation for this. I really think that the most likely scenario that winds up looking like, I think it's a cyber attack. I think that's how they're going to respond. Just because launching a missile, that goes against the whole mutually assured destruction kind of thing. If they launch one against us, then of course we wind up launching one against them. And so there's a pattern there that I don't think Putin is willing to, I just don't think he's willing to go there. And so what I think is going to happen is there is going to be a Russian-led cyber attack. And we've seen them sort of dip their toe in the water when it came to cyber attacks. Of course, they tried to involve themselves in our elections, wound up not working, wound up not affecting any of the votes. But the point is, they did attempt it in several states. And so a cyber attack, I think, is the most likely outcome when it comes to retaliation. And keep in mind, this could be a very big deal. Just because it's a cyber attack doesn't mean it's not going to have lasting effects on us, because keep this in mind. In January, a cyber attack shut down a hospital for over a week. So that shut down a hospital here in the United States, I believe it was in Boston, for over a week. And their computers were still down. They still had no way to get there. They had to go to administering care to patients through paperwork and everything else. So it became a real hassle. It became a real problem that they didn't have their computers to rely on. And the hospital wound up having to actually shut down. Last year, a cyber attack shut down 65 hospitals in the UK, absolutely crippling their system. Their NHS department was shut down for 65 different hospitals. This lasted several days. Last January, a hospital paid $17,000 in ransom to get its computers back. There was a ransomware attack. And so what happens in a ransomware attack is they basically hold your data hostage. And they say, if you pay us this amount, we'll give you the code to unlock your own computer. And so a hospital actually paid $17,000 in ransom to get its own computers back. Hospitals were crippled in Canada, Kentucky, and two of them were crippled in California. So this is something that has happened here in the United States as well. Just 4 days ago, a chain of 10 hospitals in the Washington, D.C. area were shut down by ransomware. So taking control of their hospital systems. There have been multiple attacks on other targets other than hospitals. That's just a big one because, of course, that can affect a lot of us. And that's been a very popular target in the past 2 years for cyber attacks, because they know it's an emergency situation and people are willing to pay to get their data back in a lot of those cases, and so hospitals have become a very attractive target to ransomware people. And there have also been military targets. There have been businesses that have been targeted. We can look over the past with a big company like Sony, a Japanese company, being targeted with that. So cyber attacks are a very big deal, and they can cripple. Think about all that a cyber attack could do. Like I said earlier, if our computers went down, the radio wouldn't run. So cyber attacks can be a very serious deal. It can really cripple our communication, our infrastructure. And I want you to keep in mind that in each of the situations, each of the scenarios that I just talked about, every one that we know of so far, those were all amateur attacks by every measure that we're aware of right now. And if that's an amateur attack, if that's just a bunch of computer hackers getting together and writing a program to mess up somebody's computer, imagine what an actual state-sponsored organization like Russia would be able to do. Imagine their capabilities when it comes to what they are able to do in a cyber attack. I think that's what's going to happen. I think that's the retaliation that we're going to see by Vladimir Putin. Putin himself once said that the next war is not going to be fought with bombs and missiles. It's going to be fought with ones and zeros. And because of that, he's built up his infrastructure kind of reflecting that mentality. And they could do a lot of damage in a very short amount of time to us with that. Hour two coming up.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Despite everything going on in the world, apparently we have to talk about James Comey, so we're going there next on Tactics. Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, that is the number that you want to call if you want to get into the show. Welcome back into the Situation Room. Hour two of Tactics is on right now. And I got to be honest, I'm frankly annoyed that I even have to talk about this, but it's the number one news story. Everybody's talking about it because of James Comey's book coming out tomorrow and the interview that happened the other day. And I got incredibly frustrated this morning going through all the news, and all anybody seemed to want to talk about was Comey. Despite everything going on in Syria, you'll notice that we led with that and talked about that for an entire hour and are just now getting to James Comey. That's the way the news should be run. That's really where the priorities ought to be. The idea that the media is just having this slobbering love affair with James Comey because he's saying things that about Trump that they think are true, and frankly, there is a lot of truth to what he's saying, but my biggest issue with the whole thing is most of this information is not new information. It's not shocking information. There's not a bombshell, because if what James Comey is saying, and keep in mind, the book does not come out until tomorrow, but based on what I'm seeing so far, if the stuff that Comey is going out and talking about is the big bombshell reveal, then Comey's got absolutely nothing. No new information, nothing that we didn't already know. Maybe a little bit of insight into his side of what was going on, but again, it doesn't do anything but maybe confirm some things that people were already pretty sure about anyway. So this book effectively does nothing. But because all the big news outlets are talking about it, we're going to talk about it. And I do want to mention this. I have in the past defended at least some of Comey's actions. I'm careful not to defend any one person themselves, because I don't want to be a cheerleader for any one person. When they do something right, I try to give them credit for it. When they do something wrong, I will criticize them for it. I was incredibly critical of him not recommending charges against Hillary Clinton. I was incredibly critical of the way he handled the incident to where he reopened the investigation and did so late. If he had been paying attention to his own department, that would have happened 3 weeks earlier. But nonetheless, Nonetheless, just looking at it now, I have, for the longest time, been on the fence about Comey because anybody that you see go back and forth that much where the Republicans hate him one week and the Democrats love him and then vice versa the next week, to me, that is an indication that they are a good person and they're doing their job, which is rare in Washington. I no longer believe that's the case, because if the past couple weeks have shown us anything about James Comey, it is that he is absolutely 100% in it for himself. He is in this for James Comey, and that's really seemingly the only person that he cares about. The media is lapping this up and trying to cater to this narrative that James Comey is this diligent public servant that is just worried about the country and just doing this out of concern for others, except they're never asking the big question, the where's the cameraman question. And the reason that I give that analogy, I'll try not to get too far off on a tangent, but I will occasionally, because I think like a broadcaster, I'll have friends that would watch. I had brothers, for example, in my fraternity that watched these survival shows that would be about these people going out into the woods and doing things. And even some reality shows like Duck Dynasty, they'd be out in the woods or whatever. And they'd be like, oh, man, look how dangerous it is there. I was like, you guys realize they have a camera crew there, right? Like, it can't be that dangerous. They can't be in that much trouble if there's a camera crew there. And so you have to keep in mind that the medium you're watching it on, the media that you're viewing this on, has something to play with it. If you look at it from the meta level, if you're looking at it from the how is this being presented to me level, there's a question there. And that's what the media is missing about the James Comey thing, because if James Comey was really this incredibly worried civil servant that was concerned about what the president was going on, and he has all these bombshells that show who Trump really is and makes the public aware of this, if that was really his end goal, then why release a book about it? Why release it in such a medium to where people have to pay you to get it? If this is such important information about the president of our United States, why wait a year and release all this after the fact? Release all this after all this has taken place. If this was something that you were so incredibly concerned about, why not just go and do interviews and talk to people in the media and get this information out that way? It kind of goes back to the Stormy Daniels thing in a little bit. I'm not saying that the two are connected, but it reminds me of the Stormy Daniels thing, where if Stormy Daniels was so... if she was this noble figure just trying to tell the American people what their president is really like, well, then why doesn't she give back the $130,000? That would prove that she's really not in it for the money. Same thing with James Comey. If James Comey was really trying to get this information out there and get it to the public and trying to help them understand who President Trump is, then why hold on to this information until you get a book deal that'll probably sell millions of copies? If that was your goal, if getting the information out was the goal, it was the end in and of itself, then why not just present that information to the American people in a public forum? It doesn't make any sense. It shows that his motivation is really with himself. And here's another thing. There's really nothing new in this whole thing. We got from the story that he's been telling the other night and telling, going and making the media rounds, with the FBI and the White House, for example, talking about how he doesn't really understand the difference in the White House doing certain things to help him with the press and the FBI doing that. He talked about he was asking the FBI to disseminate information that says, hey, you know, I'm not the one under investigation. Okay, well, that proves that Donald Trump knows virtually nothing about the way that government works. He doesn't understand that that's not the FBI's job. But we already knew that about Donald Trump. We know that he doesn't know anything about the government. Now, how people understand that and still voted for him is beyond me. But the point is, this is not new information. The fact that Trump is a political novice, that he doesn't really understand the inner workings of government, the different agencies and what they're supposed to do, that is not new information. So acting as though this is some massive bombshell is just, frankly, it doesn't make any sense. We also know that he, for the longest time, denied that there was any Russian involvement in the election, that he saw that as a slight against him personally or an attack against the legitimacy of his presidency, and so he denied it for a long time. I've been very critical of the president on this. I think that he's still a little too hesitant to talk about Russian involvement in the elections. That is a legitimate problem, but again, it is not new information. So the idea that this book is bringing out new information, new revealing things that we didn't know about the Trump administration before, so far has proven to be not true. And we also know, and this is kind of the reason that the book is titled what it is, A Higher Loyalty, that Trump is obsessed with loyalty. Again, this is stuff we already knew, and the story that Comey presented actually already has been presented to the public at least once before, at least the big one that he was talking about, where he was asking for the president or asking for the FBI director's loyalty, that he saw the FBI as an agency that is supposed to do his bidding. I hope that the president has kind of come to realize that is not the case, especially with Jeff Sessions. But again, we already knew that about the president. We already knew that he wants people to be loyal to him, that he wants people to carry his water for him if they're working in one of his agencies, that he's having a hard time separating his relationship with his underlings, I guess would be the best way to say it, in the Trump company versus the people that work for him in the government. And so is it a positive thing? No, it's something that I've personally been very critical of Trump on, but again, not new information. And so them acting as though this is newsworthy and is worth the time of taking up the entire news cycle for the next 24 to 48 hours, I'm sorry, you can't make that case based on this information. And another thing, too, that is a big point that Kellyanne Conway was making the rounds this morning, making this point, and it's a very good point. Why is it that James Comey, when he was talking to the president about the dossier, when he was briefing him on that, why did he not tell him that that was funded by the Democrats? Because James Comey had that information at this time. Why is it that James Comey, when he spoke to the president of the United States to tell him that this dossier is out there, this information is out here, which, by the way, he should have done, he should have come to the president and said, this is what the Russians are saying they have on you. That is something that the president needs to know about. And again, president asking him to look into it, to me, is not an unreasonable request. And to say that, you know, that this isn't substantiated, that is a reasonable request from the president. I don't see any problem with what Trump did there, where he's talking about, you know, if my wife found out about this, it would look really bad. And I don't want you know, this to look to reflect poorly on me with her. I thought that was a perfectly reasonable thing to ask, but nonetheless, he never told Trump that the source of the dossier was bought and paid for by his opposition, by Hillary Clinton, that it came from the Russians. Why not tell the president that? Why not give him that information? That is pertinent information. That is incredibly relevant. And watching Chris Cuomo this morning in an interview trying to make the case that that is not relevant, of course it's relevant. That changes the entire context of the conversation. If you reversed it, if this was something that somebody was claiming that they had on President Obama and say, oh, and by the way, it was funded by Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney bought and paid for this. Well, of course that changes the context of the conversation. It's someone that had a vested interest in making him look as bad as possible. So yes, of course that's relevant to the conversation. And I will say this, and this is kind of my final observation on the whole thing, is that for somebody who I was kind of on the fence of back and forth, whether he was actually trying to do the right thing or he was a political shill, James Comey has pretty much solidified his position as a political shill in the past few days. Because here's one thing I got to say, I think Comey has got to be the greatest politician in the country. And the reason I say that is, to this day, Hillary Clinton blames James Comey for her loss, and a lot of her supporters also blame James Comey for her loss of the presidential election. And yet, who are the people going out, carrying the water for Comey, talking about what an honorable man he is and how trustworthy he is right now? It's all the people that voted for Hillary Clinton. If that's not a masterful piece of political genius, I don't know what is. To have the very people that are blaming you for the loss of an election also being the ones that are carrying the water for you now? I mean, that's brilliant. I don't know how he pulled it off. But nonetheless, He has shown because of that he absolutely loves the spotlight. And one of the most telling lines in this book that he was talking about is that how President Obama came up to him and talked to him and talked about what a great job that he was doing. And he was saying that he really needed to hear that. And it seems to me that what he was trying to do is harken back to the good old days when President Obama was running things, as opposed to this evil, nasty Trump, which if that doesn't show you that there is an obvious bias towards one side of the aisle, I don't know what does. So the final verdict for me, unless James Comey does something incredibly drastic to change my opinion of him, is that he's a prima donna, loves the spotlight, and he has a pretty obvious political bias. It took me a while, but I think I finally sorted out exactly who Comey is, and I think with the information that we have now, it's pretty easy to see what side that he actually falls on. 860-1440, we'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
John 13:34-35, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440, that is the way to get in touch with me if you want to weigh in on what we are talking about. And one thing that interesting that happened over the, well, I guess this was, I'm not sure if this one was Thursday or Friday, because Mike Pompeo, who is, of course, the new Secretary of State nominee, he is going through his confirmation process right now, and the hearings were on Thursday and Friday. He's going to get confirmed if he hasn't already been confirmed. Actually, I don't have the news feed pull up. He might have already been confirmed. I don't believe that's, I think that vote's actually taking place today. But his confirmation hearings have been Thursday and Friday, and there are several people that have been questioning him on that. The Democrats really understand that he's probably going to get confirmed regardless, because the Republicans hold the majority in the Senate. But nonetheless, there were a couple of really interesting exchanges here that I wanted to go over. Cory Booker, for example, had some questions about Mike Pompeo, and he goes off into this weird rant about some really common beliefs that Mike Pompeo has that are pretty indicative of common Christian beliefs, especially when it comes to homosexuality. Let's go ahead and take a listen.
I have a minute left because I do want to give you a chance to speak about your comments on gay and lesbians. You said in a speech that mourning an America that endorses perversion and calls it an alternative lifestyle, those are your words. Is being gay a perversion?
Senator, I, when I was a politician, I had a very clear view on whether it was appropriate for two same-sex persons to marry. I stand by that.
So you do not believe it's appropriate for two gay people to marry?
Senator, I continue to hold that view. It's the same view.
And so people in the State Department, I met some in Africa, that are married under your leadership, you do not believe that that should be allowed?
Senator, I believe it's the case, we have married gay couples at the CIA. You should know I treated them with the exact same set of rights.
You believe that? You believe that gay sex is a perversion? Yes or no,
Senator? If I can, if
yes or no, sir. Do you believe that gay sex is a perversion? Because that's what you said here,
Senator,
in one of your speeches. Yes or no? Do you believe gay sex is a perversion,
Senator? I'm going to give you the same answer I just gave you previously. My respect for every individual, regardless of their sexual orientation, is the same.
Okay, so that's Cory Booker. First of all, what does that have anything to do with being Secretary of State? I have absolutely no idea what this has to do with running the State Department. And again, Cory Booker cannot keep from, I don't know. With Cory Booker, it does seem as though any kind of orthodox Christian belief when it comes to homosexuality, at least based on this exchange, means that he believes that you are not qualified or that is problematic when serving in any public office, because the State Department has nothing to do with what he's talking about. It is completely unconnected. And I don't understand why this would be an issue if he genuinely believes this, which if he's a Christian, if he believes what the Bible says about homosexuality, then of course it's a perversion. It is a perversion of the natural way that God put us into place, the way that God created us, which is a man shall leave his father and mother and cling to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. That is true from the beginning, the creation. It's the same story that Christ cites when asked about his stances on marriage. And so the marriage is very, very clearly defined in the Bible as being specifically between a man and a woman for life, period. And for any perversion of that, which is by definition what it would be if you believe that that is the correct way, anything different than that would be a perversion. It would be an incorrect way to look at it, at least from a biblical perspective. And so essentially, what Cory Booker is saying here is that he believes that if you hold an Orthodox Christian view on homosexuality, what is the, in essence, you believe what the Bible says about it. And by the way, this would not be limited specifically to Christians. This is also the view held by Jews and Muslims. So out of the four world major religions, three of them believe that homosexuality is a perversion. It is a sin. It is something that is a perversion of the correct use of sexuality, which is a man and his wife. Thus, according to Cory Booker, if you are a Christian and believe what the Bible says, you cannot serve for public office. You cannot serve in any capacity in public office. And here's the thing. Not only is that incorrect, not only is that wrong to believe, but also it is a direct violation of the Constitution of the United States. Article 6, paragraph 3. The senators and representatives before mentioned, and the members of the several state legislators and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath of affirmation to support the Constitution, but no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. Cory Booker just administered a religious test. He asked him about his religion. He asked him about his religious beliefs. And he believes that those religious beliefs, based on what he's saying here, based on this content, he believes that that disqualifies him from serving in public office. So not only did Cory Booker do something that is morally reprehensible, but he also violated the Constitution in doing so. That is administering a religious test to see if he is fit to serve in that office. And he continues on. Let's listen to this one as well. This is Cory Booker, again, questioning Mike Pompeo. This is sort of the tail end of what they're talking about.
So I will conclude by saying,
if I'm confirmed,
I will conclude by saying, sir, you're going to be Secretary of State of the United States at a time that we have an increase in hate speech and hate actions against Jewish Americans, Muslim Americans, Indian Americans. Hate acts are on the increase in our nation. You're going to be representing this country and their values abroad in nations where gay individuals are under
again, so has nothing to do with the State Department.
Untold violence. Your views do matter. You're going to be dealing with Muslim states and on Muslim issues. And I do not necessarily concur that you are performing the values of our nation when you can't even when you believe that there are people in our country that are perverse.
Okay, so first of all, Cory Booker can't stop campaigning for more than 10 consecutive seconds to actually do his job and ask a question relevant to this hearing. But nonetheless, you can hear, by the way, he runs over him earlier in this. He says, hold on, I want to give this conclusion. So in other words, Cory Booker wants to use the remainder of his time not to get an answer out of Mike Pompeo, but to give his own opinions on whether or not he should be confirmed. In other words, he's really not interested in an answer. He just wants to present this and then run roughshod over Mike Pompeo to explain that, well, this means that you should not be Secretary of State. And here's another thing that I wanted to bring out. Are we now to believe, because listen to the way that he ends that. He says, you can't believe that people are a perversion. Does Cory Booker then, is what he's saying, if I'm understanding him correctly, that someone that believes that there are people that are acting in perversion, that there are no people in the United States that act that way? That there is nobody that is perverse, according to Cory Booker. You can't have somebody in the State Department that believes that there are people in this country that are perverse. So in a country of 320 million, each person who would potentially become the Secretary of State or hold any office, he cannot believe that there's not even one perverse person in that entire crowd, because that's what Cory Booker just said. Nobody's perverse. There's no perversion out there whatsoever, because that's going to make it really hard for the hashtag MeToo movement people to make the case that guys like Harvey Weinstein are acting incorrectly. Of course there's perversion. Of course there's sexual perversion and perversion of all other kinds in this country. Believing that doesn't make you a crazy person. Believing that doesn't disqualify you. I'm sure that there's a number of people that if he thought about it for, you know, I know thinking's not his strong suit, but if Cory Booker would actually sit down and think about it, there's people that Cory Booker could name that he believes are a perversion, that are acting in a perverse manner. I would hope to think that he would think that people who engage in child sacrifice, devil worship, that want to kill people, that rape people, that those are all perversions. Those are all evil acts that men carry out. And yet Cory Booker gives this idea that because Mike Pompeo believes that homosexuality is a perversion, or that really anything is a perversion, according to his last statement, that means that he cannot serve as the Secretary of State. You see, here's the issue. Like most liberals, Booker cannot comprehend that thinking something is immoral, but that doesn't mean that it should be illegal. See, there are a lot of things that I think are immoral. Lying, for example, is immoral. Having an affair is immoral. There's a lot of things that the Bible says is immoral. That does not mean that you think they ought to be illegal. Mike Pompeo is not saying that we should have stormtroopers barge into people's bedrooms and stop them from having sex with a member of the same sex as them. That is not what he's suggesting. He's saying that here, that it is a perversion, that he believes it to be wrong. And that's the belief of millions of Americans. That's the belief of any Christian. If you believe what the Bible is saying, then of course you believe that. But see, you have to understand, with the liberal mindset, because really the government is God, the government is the one that determines morality, that whatever the government says, that is what is correct. If you believe that, which is the liberal mindset, then you must also believe that immoral action must be banished. It must be made illegal. Conservatives generally don't believe that. There is a difference in thinking something is immoral and thinking something ought to be illegal. And that's something that is hard for him to comprehend. And I do think it's ironic that Cory Booker brings up Muslims specifically, because I have a hard time believing that if it were a Muslim that had been nominated to Secretary of State, regardless of what they had said about homosexuality in the past, I have a hard time believing that Cory Booker would be trying to hold their feet to the fire on that issue. I'm sorry, I just don't buy that he would say to a Muslim person, which their religion also teaches, that homosexuality is wrong. Now, one of the difference being that they believe homosexuality ought to be executed, which is not a Christian belief. But the point is, I have a hard time believing that Cory Booker would have said the same thing and reacted the same way to a Muslim person trying to become Secretary of State. 860-1440, we'll be right back.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com.
As to Jesus of Nazareth, my opinion of whom you particularly desire, I think the system of morals in his religion, as he left them to us, the best the world ever saw or is likely to see. Benjamin Franklin.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440. And newsradio1440.com, 860-1440. That is the way to get in touch with me if you're interested in doing so. And speaking of that, we do have a caller on the phones right now. So let's go to John from Millbrook. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, I wanted to weigh in on this.
Sure.
The interviewer of the proposed Secretary of State.
Yeah, Senator Booker.
Like many on the left, they're trying to force a morality and an acceptance of something that a high percentage of the people still don't accept, and trying to bait him into accepting an activity or a lifestyle that he would never accept because of his beliefs.
Well, and that's the thing. It's not enough.
More.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that's going to continue to be one of the talking points, for lack of a better phrase, that will continue to try to divide us up into different camps, as it were. If you think homosexual activities are perverted, then you're definitely an immoral person, and you're judgmental, and you're, you know, the list could go on about the kinds of judgments that will be cast on you because of your convictions with this.
Well, and that's the thing that Mike Pompeo does answer. He says, my record's very clear on this. There have been gay people that served under me that have worked for me. I treat them with respect. See, to Cory Booker, that's not enough. You have to wholesale accept their lifestyle and say that it's a wonderful thing or else you're a terrible person.
I would have said that just like many of our Muslim friends, our Jewish friends, and Christian fundamentalists, are they don't accept it either, and neither do I.
Well, and that is very indicative of the Christian faith. If you believe what the Bible has to say about it in the first chapter of Romans, what Christ says about it in Matthew 19, you see this over and over again in 1 Corinthians. I mean, there's no shortage of passages that we could talk about that homosexuality is something that is sinful. It is an immoral lifestyle. It is something that many of the early century Christians, the first century Christians, were actually involved in and then turned away from because they were formerly pagans. They came to know God. They gave up that lifestyle because Christian teaching says that that is a moral lifestyle, that it is a perversion of God's intention for human sexuality, which is between a man and his wife. And that's the only sexual interaction that God allows under his plan and under his teachings. And so that being said, I will say this. I do wish that there was some kind of example. If there was only some kind of example that we had of someone who served, maybe even as Secretary of State, but certainly in some form of public office, if only there was somebody who had served as Secretary of State that had said similar things, and maybe if they were on the other side, see if they were treated the same way. I wish there was an example of that. Maybe I can find one.
I believe that marriage is not just a bond, but a sacred bond between a man and a woman. I have had occasion in my life to defend marriage, to stand up for marriage, to believe in the hard work and challenge of marriage. So I take umbrage at anyone who might suggest that those of us who worry about amending the Constitution are less committed to the sanctity of marriage or to the fundamental bedrock principle that it exists between a man and a woman going back into the mists of history as one of the foundational institutions of history and humanity and civilization, and that its primary principal role during those millennia has been the raising and socializing of children for the society into which they are to become adults.
That sounds like fundamental Christian teaching. What was that lady's name? She was in a pantsuit. She had that short blonde hair, screechy voice. Oh, yeah, that's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton back in 2004 from the Senate floor. I don't remember her going through this and getting grilled by Democrats on her stances on marriage. She got confirmed pretty quickly. In fact, when she was confirmed, she was appointed by President Barack Obama, who said, in less strong language, but pretty much exactly the same thing, that he believed marriage should be between a man and a woman. That's it. So it's amazing to me that Cory Booker nor any of the Democrats, because, of course, Cory Booker wasn't a senator when Clinton was being confirmed, but it's amazing to me that he never took her to task on that and never apparently had any problem with Hillary Clinton serving as Secretary of State even back when she held the belief that marriage was between a man and a woman. Now, she's, of course, gone back on that. She has changed her policy on that. But at the time she took the oath of office and went through the confirmation of Secretary of State, she had not said that she had revoked that belief. She continued to believe that, according to her. So why is it the Democrats did not see it fit to grill her when it came to her confirmation hearing as Secretary of State? Keep in mind, she said that that was a foundational principle of humanity and society, which would imply what? That anything else would be a, oh, that's that word again, a perversion. A perversion of the correct model of marriage, which would be between, as Hillary Clinton just stated, a man and a woman. That anything that deviates from that would be, by definition, a perversion, if you're talking about, as she just did, the sanctity of marriage. In other words, that marriage is something that, as she believes, at least she said right there she did, is something that is a sacred bond. In other words, it is something that is set aside, that it is separated from what would be the, what would it be separated from? It would be separated from perversion. And so, yet, despite these comments, I don't remember a single Democrat opposing or saying anything to Hillary Clinton during her confirmation as Secretary of State. But, I mean, that's just one example. It's not like, I mean, surely I couldn't find another example of somebody who was Secretary of State that said the same thing. Oh, wait, John Kerry.
I believe marriage is between a man and a woman. But I also believe that because we are the United States of America, we're a country with a great, unbelievable constitution with rights that we afford people, that you can't discriminate in the workplace. You can't discriminate in the rights that you afford people.
Hmm. So that's Secretary of State John Kerry, Barack Obama's second Secretary of State after Hillary Clinton had to leave, basically saying exactly what Mike Pompeo said, which is he believes that from a legal perspective and from a moral perspective, marriage should be between a man and a woman, and that people shouldn't be discriminated against, that you shouldn't treat people with less respect because they're homosexual, but that doesn't mean you endorse their lifestyle or give them some kind of special legal status. John Kerry just basically said, and that was back in the presidential debates in 2000, basically said exactly what Mike Pompeo believes. And yet nobody grilled him when he was going through his confirmation as Secretary of State. In fact, Kerry, back in the day, supported a ban on gay marriage in the state of Massachusetts. He supported it, said that he would support it. He didn't support it, actually, because it never came up on the floor, but he said if that were to take place, then he would vote in favor of it. He would support a ban on gay marriage in the state of Massachusetts. And yet, Democrats never made a fuss over him becoming Secretary of State. It's almost as though when it's a Democrat, it's okay, but when it's a Republican, it becomes a problem. That really shouldn't be surprising to any of us. Is it any wonder, based on this, that Christians in this country feel that they're under attack, that their beliefs are under attack? There is an open, vehement hatred and disdain for fundamental Christian teachings by many on the left. Maybe not necessarily all of the voters, maybe not necessarily everybody that refers to themselves as a Democrat, but certainly by the people on the top and certainly by people like Cory Booker, who is now seen as a leader in the Democrat Party. One of the top senators, according to a lot of people think of him as being one of the more influential senators on the Democrat side. These are people that are leading the party, and seeing this kind of open disdain and hostility, wanting nobody that has traditional Christian worldviews to be able to serve in public office, no wonder Christians in this country feel as though we're under attack. Chaplin's report is up next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Galatians 5:1. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. The Chaplain's Report is on, and we do have something to discuss from Jeremiah. And really what you have to understand about this particular passage is Jeremiah has spent the majority of this chapter really talking about prophesying the captivity of Judah. And of course, we know that eventually did happen. Jeremiah being the prophet that he was, he predicted that Judah was going to be taken over by Babylon. And so he's been talking about this and what that's going to look like, giving this prophecy. And then we see him in Jeremiah 13:22 through 24. He says, to Judah, issuing this warning, if you say in your heart, why have these things happened to me? Because of the magnitude of your iniquity, your skirts have been removed and your heels have been exposed. Can the Ethiopian change his skin or the leopard change his spots? Then you also can do good, who are accustomed to doing evil. Therefore, I will scatter them like a drifting straw to the desert wind. The Bible is very clear that sometimes really terrible things happen to good people. That is something that the Bible talks about over and over again. We see the story of Job, we see the story of Joseph, we see the story of Christ himself. Sometimes really horrible things happen to people that are doing the right thing. However, here's an example where God is talking about people that are suffering because of their own wicked deeds. They are inviting suffering into their lives because of the evil that they have done. And so many times where it talks about God punishing Israel or punishing these other nations, there is an element of truth in that he punishes them. But usually that form of punishment isn't so much that God creates some kind of terrible scenario to befall them. 9 times out of 10, what actually happens is that God just kind of takes away his hand of protection and lets whatever terrible consequence that they have caused themselves, that he has been holding back, he allows that to befall them. And we see this as a parenting technique that is very effective in parents all around the world. You tell your kids not to do something, you protect them from the consequences of their actions in most scenarios, but sometimes the most effective method to get them to really understand why something is harmful to them, why they shouldn't do something, is to allow them to suffer the consequences of their own actions. And this is what the Lord is talking about here in this prophecy, that God is allowing Judah to suffer for the evil things that they have done. And eventually he is going to rescue them. Eventually they do return to Jerusalem and all that takes place, but it takes a really long time. And they suffer a lot in the meantime because of it, because they turned away from God, they worshiped other gods, they refused to acknowledge him and to worship him the way he demanded to be worshiped. And because of that, and because of the evil deeds that they take and the sin that they involve themselves with, he allows them to fall prey to their own iniquity. So why the harsh punishment? Why is this taking place? Why is it that God protected them for a while and now is basically saying, no, you're going to be on your own for a little bit and think about what you've done? Because they had turned evil into a habit. It's one thing to commit a sin and then repent and try to do better. It's even one thing to commit multiple sins, but really strive to make it better, to try to do better in the future. What Judah had done, and this is indicative from verse 23 here, talking about the leopard changing his spots or the Ethiopian changing his sin, you are more likely to do good. They had turned evil into a habit. They had turned evil into a lifestyle. And because they had turned evil into a lifestyle, God had turned them over to suffer for what they had done because they had turned it into who they were. It was an identifying feature for them, kind of like a leopard with his spots. It had become a part of who they were, and God could not tolerate that. And once a habit is formed, it is not easy to break. That is why the Bible recommends that we make good habits of doing good works and following Christ and his teachings, as opposed to giving ourselves over to evil. Instead of being overcome with evil, we in turn make good habits of doing good and overcome evil with good. Stay the course, friends. Light's getting brighter.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.